The title of this session, as all the sessions are, is What Could X Be? This is What Could Prayer Be? And I want you to just speak with the person that you just met. Be extremely vulnerable with them. And just talk about what you think prayer could be for you. That is to say, if you were going to pick an aspect of prayer, and I know apparently you're all here because you're pushing yourself because you don't really like prayer and you'd all rather be in the halacha session, but still, if you could think about prayer in a positive sense, what could prayer be for you, sort of the aspirational view of prayer for yourself? Just if you can talk about that for a few minutes with the person you're next to, that's my request.
Okay, let's come back together. I want to hear if you're willing to share and not violate any confidentiality. I'd be curious to hear something that struck you or surprised you, or either about something that you said, if you had no prep for this, you might have said something you hadn't thought about, or something that your partner said, something that was stuck with you, surprised you, struck you. Yeah.
We were talking a little bit about, like, kind of, there's meaning that comes from, like, two opposite kind of understandings of tefillah, like, or, like, ways of approaching tefillah, which is, like, on the one hand, there's something beautiful out of, like, that comes out of obligation, and then, like, I'm doing this because I'm required to, because God expects this of me, and it's important, and so there's something beautiful that comes with that, but on the other hand, there's something beautiful that comes with, like, davening when you don't have a sense of obligation and being like, this is an active choice I'm making, and this is I'm volunteering this time, and therefore I'm like elevating this time beyond something that's required of me, and vice versa, the things that are lost on each of those.
Right. In some ways, it was reminding me of what Rav Shai spoke about on Friday night, of the sort of the constancy and the, you know, the moments of ecstasy that play out in tefillah. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I love praying here because it's a hotel room and it's not a synagogue and nobody has their ordinary seats and everyone's close.
But by Sunday they did.
Well,
actually, you were sitting by a seat on Sunday.
Yeah, close together, and there's no normal. So it's not like someone say, "Oh, that's not the way we did it," or the cantor introduced something new. It's all. Well, first of all, it's a great team, and everybody is praying. There's nobody here sitting back and saying, I just came to let it wash over me. I love the sort of the impromptu nature of bringing a team together like this and praying hard. And there are no donor plaques. There's no...
Or should they, right?
Tuesday. I'm going to ask you on Tuesday. I appreciate it. The thing about the relationship between prayer and space, I mean, you're talking about the unfamiliarity of the space and also the community, who's filling the room and what are the norms of expectation. So many, like the baseline prayer spaces that we all go to just by definition have a history.
Yeah.
And this didn't have a history, and you have the plus and minus of that. Any other thing that sort of emerged from you in your... Yeah?
Well, I'm kind of following up on that term. We were talking about... I'm going to talk to you a little bit, but the different prayer experiences that one can have in different settings and how we like bits and pieces of each of those. And wouldn't it be nice if we could set up a prayer service, kind of to your point, that would take the best of or the things that are most moving of those and put them all in one spot? Of course, that's never going to happen. We are Jews, after all. But I think that's a reality in communities that do daven in different settings, that you realize, wow, I really like that piece, or I really like that piece. Why can't I get it all in one place?
Yeah, it's the Ketoret image that Ethan was talking about in some ways. Yeah, although we once did, years ago, we did a retreat, a tefillah retreat with Eben Leder, and he said something that struck me, which we dove in this Kabbalat Shabbat, he was leading, and it was like, I was like, very happy. but it was like 2 hours, so some people were not happy. And he was reflecting afterwards, because it was the subject of the retreat, he said something suddenly, which was, there were 60 people at the retreat. He said, 60 people, 60 different davening experiences. It's like you're all in the same room, and certain people are relating to certain aspects of it in totally different ways. And anything else that emerged from you? From this side of the room? Yeah.
Okay. Number one, the need for being in a group, community, where you know the people, seems to be an important element, which is what we were trying to do right now, I gather. The other thing is that even within that consistent group, there has to rather be a variety of styles of prayer. What happens, right? Okay. In other words, not predictably, this is the way the prayer format is. Yes, we have a whatever, it's a little different. But actually opportunity for having different varieties that really were different from each other within that same group. I brought up at the end of our conversation the problems of, well, music, important, length of prayer, big question mark, how much to be said from the traditional liturgy, that's an open question. And the other thing is the words themselves, even under the best circumstances with the beautiful, most beautiful melodies, and that's a really big contribution, like what Joey's doing and other great musicians that are out there, is that language itself, however you want to translate it even in the best of English, it's problematic today.
Great. Okay, this would be a great transition to some of the difficulties that that arise in prayer and maybe some of the ways in which I want to offer some of my own perspectives on this and draw out some of what you already have been saying and connect it to some texts. Because after all, it's Hadar, and come on. So, let's do this. So Xerox on very nice paper. Okay. So I was trying to think about the ways in which we could, in a relatively short amount of time, try to touch on some of the big points of what prayer could be. And I want to, even if you take nothing away from the specifics, I wanted to offer just a general frame about multiplicity of experience in prayer that I'm going to try to fill in some of the holes on of what potential aspects of that experience might be. But even just the metaphor of what it means to have multiple experiences in prayer is what I want to start off with. So there's an amazing statement that comes twice in the Gemara, actually very close to each other, which I'm going to start off here on page 1, about praying in a room with windows. Amar b'chia bar Abba, le'olam yipalel adam b'bayit she'yesh bo chalonot. You should always pray, yipalel, you should always pray, or a person should always pray, in a house that has windows. She'ne'emar, as it says, and then they quote a verse from Daniel, and if you flip over the page, you can see the full text from Daniel. So just flip over page for 1 second to page 2. Aramaic, and we're reading in English. When Daniel learned that it had been put in writing, this was the decree to snuff out all the wise men of the government, modern parallels to be bracketed, and he went to his house, in whose upper chamber he had windows made facing Jerusalem. And 3 times a day he knelt down, prayed, and made confession to his God as he had always done. Now from this verse, actually, it's a lot of prayer rules that are derived from this verse, including praying 3 times a day, and also what it means to pray by yourself. I know the halacha is somewhere else, but there's a great halacha thing. Someone writes into the Rambam an actual question that says, in my shul, like in the 12th century, there are no windows. So am I allowed to pray in my shul? After all, it says in the Talmud, you always have to pray in a room with windows. So you know what the Rambam writes back? He writes back and he says, don't worry, it's actually about personal prayer. Babayit, okay? If you're in a house and you're praying alone, and after all, Daniel is presumably praying alone in his attic with a window that looks out toward Jerusalem. He's in exile, he's looking towards Jerusalem. So it's this idea of, no, don't worry, the shul can be as, you know, church basement-y as you want, but once you get into your own space, that's where the requirement for windows are, so you don't have to do a construction project, okay? But what's striking is, why? Why do you need to pray in a room with windows? What is it about the window that offers you a different experience of prayer? So why do you think? What is it about? Gemara doesn't say, except that it quotes Daniel.
It does orient you to the outside world, obviously, but the cardinal directions of what's south, east, west.
Okay, so you can actually kavanah, the sort of the bugaboo word that we're, which is usually preceded by the phrase "I've never had good." Okay, so kavanah actually means direction, lechavein. And you're supposed to lechavein aruchot. You're supposed to actually figure out where you are in relation to north, south, east, and west. So maybe that's part of it. Yeah.
And what I'm wondering if it's more metaphorical. By creating the window in the attic, he's removed a barrier, the wall between himself and God.
Uh-huh. Okay, good. Maybe there's a barrier issue that the window allows you to literally open up. By the way, there's another law that says you should always pray next to a wall. So what are you going to do?
I think that we often think about prayer as like an isolated experience in like a particular space where like that's the only thing in that space. But I think that having windows allows you to like remember what's going on around you so that you're also connected to the rest of the world while praying.
Good. Okay, there's a sense of, especially when you're praying by yourself, right, of like I'm going into my own internal depths and I'm dealing with all my stuff. But to actually have the window open up onto the world is, you know, might give you some sense of I'm taking me out of the middle. And the window helps you do that. Mm-hmm. It's actually, please.
So you can see creation.
Yeah, what aspect specifically? Like what?
Well, actually I'm created as opposed to what man created.
Oh, okay, right. Maybe it's like, if I'm just praying in a room where all man-made stuff is, then I get that kind of orientation towards life. But if I'm looking out into a world where, who thought when Ethan spoke about the smells of America, he was going to say deciduous forest in March? Okay, that was surprising. But he's been playing in a room with windows for a long time, and maybe he's been looking at those forests and smelling them. Whereas we're riding the subway. Okay, so I want to offer you two versions of how the classical commentators understand this. This is Rashi and Rabbeinu Yonah. So Rashi, just back on page one, Rashi, which is sort of a version of what you're saying, David, although taking a slightly different direction, he says, Chalonot, Rashi's commenting on the windows where he says, they cause him to direct his heart, Shagor Mimlo Shechaven Libo, for, this is Kavanah direction, Shomistakel Klape Shamayim, he looks at heaven, Vilibo Nichna, and he experiences sort of the fear of heaven, and his heart becomes submissive. That is to say, now maybe that's a version of what you're saying, which is that you experience God's created world and then your heart sort of reacts to that. Now he's sort of saying a particularly submissive reaction to that. Maybe it's wonder, maybe it's joy. He's sort of emphasizing that. But the idea is that you look out towards the sky. That is to say, a window in New York or this window doesn't really do much for you because you actually can't see what you're supposed to see, according to Rashi, which is the sky, which is going to have you relate to God in a certain kind of way. Okay? Now Rabbeinu Yonah says something different. It's the next one down, and he says, it's possible to say, he's throwing out possibilities because it's not clear. Efshar lomar sha'atam u'mipni mipnei sh'al yedei riyata or tityashev dato yoter v'yuchal lechaven kara'ui. If you see the light, that's what you were saying? Okay, good. If you see the light, now this is not seeing the sky per se, but you experience the light. That is to say, if you're in a darkened room, you're missing the point. But if light is coming in, then tityashev da'ato, you will be, and it's hard to translate, but like, you will sort of be relaxed. You will calm down. Your mental state will adjust, okay? Your da'at, your intellect, or your consciousness will be returned, you know, will be settled in some way. Okay, there's something about the experience of, so for Rashi, it's you're looking outward, and you're trying to see something that is, you know, unattainable. For Rabbeinu Yonah, you're experiencing something coming inward, right? It's the natural phenomenon of the light, and you're interacting with the window in two different ways, okay? And this is sort of two different directions that you can move. Now, one other place I want to go with the metaphor is that this has actually been taken to the next step, because the question that you might ask, if you're in the halacha session, is, well, okay, windows, how many windows? Am I good with one window? It says, you should pray in a house with windows, not in a house with a window. So then you have to ask, well, how many windows should I have? So we don't get an answer for that in the classical sources, but you get in the Zohar, a version of a classical source, you do get an answer there. And this, you may have heard this in other contexts about the way in which people pray is related to this understanding. So just flip over to page 2. The Zohar says, the parsha we'll read soon, the lower synagogue is paralleled by the upper synagogue. This is like a good bet if you're in the Zohar, is that everything down here is up there, and everything down here can affect up there, and vice versa. Yerushalayim shalmala, Yerushalayim shalmata, right, the upper and lower. So too with Shul, right? Shul, there's a Beth El in Beth El, right? The house of God, okay? So there is, there's an upper and a lower, and the upper synagogue has windows. That's kind of amazing. Because apparently we're supposed to just look towards Shammai.
But apparently the great big Knesset Shalayim also has windows.
What's that looking at?
Exactly, right. Is it like the opposite of a skylight? The great synagogue has 12 windows, and so does the lower synagogue. Okay, so the Zohar is adding a new element here, which is, how many windows do I have? I've got 12. Now, if you've ever been in a synagogue that has stained glass windows, and each one is correlated to the tribes, this is the source of that law. It actually gets codified in the Shulchan Aruch. You know, the Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, classic halacha text in Judaism, was a mystic. He was a Kabbalist. So he like sneaks in a whole bunch of Kabbalistic things you weren't like paying attention to, like which bread you should hold on top of the other one, and things like that. So also it's like, and I'm just gonna throw in like black letter law, every shul should have 12 windows. Okay, he's grabbing it right from the Zohar. Okay, now this gets taken one final step further in the student of the Baal Shem Tov, the Magid of Mezrich. Okay, who took the Zohar and popularized it, right? Made it for Hasidim, made it something that we could all sort of understand and took it to a popular level. So this is what he says. He says, the Magid of Mezrich, in the same source here, there are 12 gates for the 12 gates of prayer for the 12 tribes, so that each person can rise through his own gate. And there is a 13th gate for the person who does not remember which tribe they are a part of and doesn't know which gate to enter to the courtyard of the king. This one is intended to go through the 13th gate. Now, there were 13 gates in the temple. Actually, another version of this sort of builds off the Mishnah. It describes the 13 gates of the temple. It's not kept coming out of nowhere, but it is striking that they, like, it's only been around for, like, a little bit, and they take the 12, and then they add another one, okay? Now, you want to use this as an image, and here are the two images I want to play with. One is, everybody has a pathway in prayer, right? That is to say, there was never an intention that there's one experience of prayer. They're already hardwired, at least from the time the Zohar forward is. The window is, everybody has their own window path to go through. There are 12 paths, which covers the extent of the people, right? Everybody can pick their path. And even every path that has been like the multiplicity of paths you could imagine isn't enough. We got to then invent another path on top of it. Right, which is like an incredible statement, which is to say, I thought I had given you all the variety that you want. You want this amount of singing, you want this amount of words, you want this amount of... And it's like, everybody's good, good, good. And then someone walks in, they're like, no, 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 I need a new path, right? And here it is. So you have like room for the 13th path. Now, the way this plays out in just the history of Sidur is that the Ari, the Nusach of the Ari, and the Nusach, what's known as Nusach Sfar, is really a combination of Nusach Ashkenaz and the Edom HaMizrach Nusach, right? The East and West Nusach, which these guys in Sfat, who were coming from Spain, but they were sort of in their own diaspora after the Inquisition, they were like mixing and matching a whole bunch of liturgies. That was their 13th gate. They said, right, in talking about 16th century, they said, wow, we don't, all the stuff that we've inherited actually doesn't work for us anymore. We need to mix and match it. Okay? So again, just as a metaphor, if you take nothing else from this, I'm gonna try to run through some particular pathways, some windows that we might walk through, but what I want to give you is some sort of encouragement that the variety of experience that we all have with prayer is hardwired into the experience of prayer to begin with. There's no monolithic prayer experience that if you're not having it, you're missing it. Everybody's got their path. And if you don't have a path, there's already precedent for making a new path. We built the shul, 12 tribes, stained glass, paid a lot of money, and now we got to build another window because we actually don't fit through any of those existing pathways. Okay? So that's, again, just the sort of table-setting metaphor that I want to leave for you. And if you take nothing else from the session, it's that finding your own path in prayer, your own window to either be experienced the outside or to look out towards is something that is not new, right? Something that is actually quite old and hopefully... we can fill in all those pathways, by the way, ourselves, in our own lives, that those windows may change as we move through our own different experiences. Okay, any thoughts, reactions, questions to the metaphor? Yeah.
It's wonderful. And I had the experience of many years ago, I knew a young Tibetan monk who was studying comparative religions at Columbia. And we had him, I think it might have been to a Shabbat dinner, but he was very interested in learning about Judaism. He looked at a talib, he immediately noticed the knots. You know, it was interesting. He was very focused and understanding. I had to make sure it wasn't mine. And he wanted to know, so what do Jews do when they pray? And I was like, okay. And the thing is that in Tibetan Buddhism, there was apparently very specific activities of the mind that were used, you know, concentration, visualization, all of the kinds of stuff. And he was kind of surprised that I couldn't really come up with a good answer. And now I see why, although I'm not sure that we don't have something to teach about the different forms of prayer.
Okay, good. Right. There are other practices that have given a lot of thought around the articulation of what we are doing in prayer. And oftentimes we can hide behind the liturgy and therefore just say, well, you want to know what we're doing here? Here's a 1,200-page book. Talk to me when you're finished reading it through. But yes, and hopefully we'll touch a little bit on what is the sort of affective aspect. We already mentioned music, the body. We're talking about windows. This is about senses more than about words. Even though they take it towards words. But yes, to sort of like try to articulate the, like, well, what do Jews do when they pray? That's, hopefully we're gonna take this a little bit. Yeah, Adina.
Yeah, I mean, this is great, and I see why you want to have this as an opening metaphor. I guess I'm wondering if you think that, you know, all the laws around how you're supposed to daven, like, were they... Yeah, how is that related? Well, this is later than the Talmud, but the Talmud isn't...
The 12 windows is later than the Talmud.
Right, it's later
but
than
the Talmud. Talmud itself is already talking about windows, right.
Right, but so do you see a conflict between the, you know, Mikvah El Tefillah, or like all the rules that go along, when you have to do it, and this is how you do it.
Right.
Or is it balancing out? I don't know. Just yeah. Like you're uncovering something that maybe...
We could spend a lot of time around the ossification of the words in davening and how that actually, how old that process is. Actually, it's somewhat of a debate, a core debate about when they say, don't change the Matbea Shel Tefillah, which is a very old statement from Yossi, what they meant by that. Did they mean, don't change any word ever? Budraham has a great statement. He's living in the 14th century in Seville. And he says, I used to think that you should never change any words in prayer because of that rule. And then he said, and then I went to the shul next door and I saw that they were not doing the same thing that I'm doing. And then I thought to myself, well, that must not mean exactly what it meant. And so how broadly you define that rule is something that's played out much later than the Talmud. And the Talmud already has an idea of there's certain things that shouldn't change. And hopefully we'll see a text that's trying to play with what changes and what doesn't. Yeah, yeah.
Well, my question relates to what you just said, but I had the question before you said it.
You get credit.
The question is, what is prayer? So when I go into my shul, which will remain anonymous, and I'm totally bored, but I bring a book of Jewish interest, and I sit in my prayer place wrapped in my towels, and I read that book, and I learn something. At the end of the tefillah, did I pray?
Yeah. Well, we could take a vote on that. It'd be interesting. I would say, let's hope so for the people who are bringing books to shul. I was once at a synagogue in Jerusalem where every single person had a book. It was unbelievable. It was like, actually, we're just having library time, but in order to get that, to put the dollars over our head, it's like amazing. You know, it's like longer half Torah, I get more reading done. You know, it's like, I hope the sermon goes long today. I've got a long chapter to get through.
That was a serious
question. No, it's a serious question. And I think that what we're going to see is, I would say classically, no. Right? Classically, there's actually a big distinction. And this is also one of the hard things about shul today. When most Jews experience shul in the context of Torah reading, you're actually mixing two aspects of the brain and two totally different rituals. One is prayer, which is wrapped around Torah reading. One is study, which is the Torah. Like, you're meant to like sit there and study the Torah. And those are like grouped together in a very fluid way that that I think that the people who are trying to lay out what prayer is would be confused by. Not to say they shouldn't be abutting each other, but that you might be able to do one activity during the other, I think is not exactly what they had in mind. All right, I want to look at some windows through which we may pass. And again, you can take or leave any of these, because you, even if we got through all 12, which we don't have, there's always a 13th that you can design yourself. Jack, it's sort of related to some of what you were saying, which I would frame as, how much of prayer is about encounter? Okay, now you could say, I encounter God through study, but how much of prayer is about encounter versus something else? Okay, now I want to bring to you a text that I find personally meaningful for me, which is on the top of page 3. It's an amazing self-critique about even how to define what prayer is. How do you say pray in Hebrew? What's the Hebrew word for pray? Lipaleo. And when you say tefillah, right? Lipaleo, tefillah, same root. For the rabbis, that almost always meant Amida. Lipaleo means to say the Amida. Okay, it's different from Shema. Okay, Shema is about a declaration. Thank you. And tefillah is about prayer. Okay, however you want to define that, it's a different activity. So let's see this amazing text here. Rabbi Pinchas, Rabbi Levi, Rabbi Yochanan, Moshe Menachem de Galia. So these three rabbis say in the name of Menachem who lived in Gaul. The one who passes before the ark, Zesh Over Lifnei Ateva, but pass before the ark is a rabbinic way of also saying, leave the Amida. Okay? The idea is that you would position yourself relative to the ark, that you're going to lead the people in prayer. She Over Lifnei Ateva. What do you say to him? You want to say, it's time for you to lead Shacharit. What do you say? In Omer Lo Bo Lipalel, Bo Vipalel. Don't say to him, come and heat Palel. Rather, Ella Bo Vik Karev. Come and, how do you translate karev?
Come close.
Come close, to draw near. And also,
sacrifice.
Korban, right? Don't say, don't come and pray, but rather, come and draw near, or do the act that is meant to draw us closer to each other, which was sacrifice. We always like write off sacrifice immediately because of like the gore and cruelty to animal side of things, which I'm not discounting. I myself couldn't stomach it for a second. But their idea, okay, of what it was meant to accomplish is encapsulated in the word korban, which is meant to draw near. You're meant to draw near. Bo bikarev. And then they say the following addition. Asay kravenu, do our, how would you translate that? Either our korbanot, maybe, or what else? Our battles. Why is it battle? Why is the Hebrew word for battle krav? Because you get really close, right? Hand to hand. It's hard to stab someone if they're on the other side of the room, right? So you're getting like hand-to-hand combat, you're getting very close. So that sort of intimacy, although violent image. Asay tzorchenu, asay milchamotenu, pies ve'adenu. Now you could make an argument that all of these are actually trying to figure out what the word karev means, right? Because it can be about doing war, which we talked about, doing sacrifices, doing our needs, but also about pius. What's pius? Yeah, to appease, right? And I think for me, one of the purposes of prayer, this is, again, you can filter it through, do I experience this in my own prayer life? One of the purposes of prayer in which they are trying to gesture at here, I think, is prayer is about yearning to draw close. Prayer is about distance and trying to bridge the distance, okay? So if prayer is not expressing, that's not to say that only successful prayer gets you closer, but that you are aware of the gap and you're yearning to cross it. That's what prayer could be about, okay? And so why don't I say bo behit palel? What's wrong with bo behit palel? Because I think when I say tefillah, the synonym for tefillah is usually bakasha. Right? What's the center of the Amida? By most ancient texts, the center is the most important. This is not the upside-down triangle of the newspaper, right? The lead is actually just the introduction. The middle, like Vayikra, most important, okay? So get ready. We're just in the prologue here in Shemot, okay? But the middle of the Amida is the most important. That's the bakashot. That's the request. That's the thing I don't have a hard time saying all the things that I want, right? But what they're trying to say is actually prayer is not about bakashot, or at least in the surface level of bakashot. It's not about request, it's about drawing near. It's about bridging a gap of distance, of sort of emotional and relational distance. You have to cross that by becoming closer, okay? Don't say bo bi palel, rather bo bi karev.
Closer to God?
Presumably. Yeah. Yeah, you're way ahead of this. You're gonna finish. You can leave early, actually. You've got it. Okay. So this is again just I'm trying to offer multiple pathways in. You can take it or leave it. That was the point of the introduction. Okay. You can take it or leave it. You can leave any of these. And if you don't like any of them, you can make your own, your 13th one. But this is one I want to put out there. What is prayer? It is about yearning to draw close. Okay. That's one thing. Then you can filter through. Did that melody draw me closer? Did this repetition draw me closer? Did this reading draw me closer? But that's the goal. Okay? That is one. Now, I want to move on to another one, then I'm going to take some of your comments. The other one Neil already brought up is the words. Okay? If we can have a separate session, which is, what could prayer not be? Or what could I complain about related to prayer? But we didn't have enough time because the conference ends today, not next Thursday. So we have to actually just think about, abridging all the issues that we have with the words. But I want to try to offer a different frame about what it means to struggle with the words of prayer. And this is another way where you could say, oh, if prayer is about drawing closer, then I know how to do that, right? I just listen to this piece of music. It lifts my heart, and I close my eyes, and I feel myself being drawn closer. But we all know that's not the extent of what, at least we've been given over as what prayer is meant to be. Okay, so what do we do with all these words? So I want to offer a commentator here who I'm absolutely in love with. Her name is Catherine Madsen. She's a contemporary professor who lives in Western Mass. She wrote a beautiful, thin book called The Bones Reassemble, which you can get for like a penny on Amazon. And it is an amazing, she actually converted to Judaism from Catholicism. She has, and she has no halachic hang-ups. This is what's amazing about her. She's not trying to defend an old world that she's holding on to. She actually brings nothing to the table in terms of baggage from that, except for whatever Catholicism stuff she's holding on to, but in terms of her frame of reference, not currently. But she is critiquing the rewriting of the Siddur from an aesthetic point of view. As she says, if you want to rewrite the Siddur, by all means, but pretty much everything that's been tried up until now is terrible. Right? That's her thing. It's like, you want to like throw out the words? Go for it. But you don't know how to rewrite the words because you haven't paid attention to what actually works. And I want to throw out for you some of her quotes here, which I think, again, get to the main challenges of words that were handed in the Siddur. She says, the most compelling liturgy does not yield all its meaning at once. It needs to withhold something so as to reveal itself over years of use. That is to say, it is not trying to express an idea at a surface level. It's not a canon, it's not a credo. It is a literary creation that's meant to be peeled back over and over again. I gave you the challenge of saying, right, you don't like the Siddur, write your own Siddur. And I want to make sure that when you're writing, you just pay attention to the fact that it's going to be used 2,000 years from now. So write sentences that will be able to last that long. Her point is that if you wrote them all clearly, if they were obvious and had nothing that was meant to be held back, then you would run out of gas with them. So actually, the way in which we experience words of the liturgy that are hard, hard to translate, hard to relate to, hard to understand, that is the benefit of the liturgy, she is saying. Right? Because if you don't hold something back, it all gets used up. This is also what she says, language designed for repetition must build in a certain intractable strangeness. Right? If you're going to say things over and over again, it can't be normal. It's got to be strange. And I would say, what's the other analog that we have to this, at least in our canon, is the Torah. Right? I've said students before, like, nobody read the Parsha and was like, got it, that was easy, let's move on to something harder, right? It's like the point of the Torah is that it is somewhat obscure, and that's why there's mounds and mounds of commentary and midrashim and people trying to explain it all the way through. I don't think, you can tell me if I'm wrong, I don't think anybody has attempted to rewrite the Torah yet. Am I wrong? Let's say like I understand there's like, we don't read a lot of the Torah anymore in liberal settings, but nobody I don't think has like walked into the scroll and said, I don't like that, I'm crossing it out. Right? That's pretty enduring. I mean, it's pretty unusual. I don't think I've seen a Torah scroll with the words purposely changed. So there's something about the Torah that is trying to say, there are words here that are meant to unfold over forever, right? Eternal. And what Catherine Madsen is trying to point out is that it's the same thing with tefillah. Not just the words themselves, but also the fact that we repeat them. I mean, the Torah you only repeat once a year. This you do repeat like 3 times a day. It's kind of amazing. So it's like as high a bar as the Torah had to be obscure, you gotta go even higher for the Siddur, right? So I think there's something powerful about thinking about what's the purpose of language in the Siddur. It's not to communicate an idea in a simple, understandable way. I want a new car. God, please give me a new car. Right? It's something that is much more complex because it needs to be enduring. And her point is a critique of language for all the liberal Siddurim that she's reading is to say, the language that you threw in there was basically a reactive language to what you were handed, but it wasn't enduring language. That's her critique. And if you want to read, it's like, it's sharp. She's like a sharp reader of text. If you want to read it detail by detail, you can do it in this book. But that's the idea, is that language in the Siddur is meant to hold something back, or to put it another way, is meant to be interpreted. So when I say I don't like the language, like it's a hard language, doesn't work for me, what her response is, you haven't unpeeled all the layers. Now you might say, believe me, I've tried, I've been working on this for years and years and decades, and it still isn't working for me. Okay, it's like a 13th window for you, right? But to say in the beginning, to write it off and say, there's nothing, this sentence has nothing for me, that's I think what she's pushing back against. Yeah.
So I'm totally willing to say that the language should be mysterious and the language should be complex. But a lot of the language is about sacrifices and about a historical context and a yearning for something that I don't yearn for.
Okay.
But the prayers are written for me to yearn for it.
I love it. Because what you said is exactly what famous Siddur editors said about certain parts. Now, by the way, pick your bugaboo. You know, if you're living in 19th century Germany, instead of saying sacrifices, you know what fits into that blank there? It's asking God to return the Jewish people to Zion. Machazir Shekhinah Tol Tzion, asking God to return to Zion, and by implication, everybody else is coming with God, right? They don't like that. Now, not because why? Because you're in 19th century Germany, and everybody's like, well, are you a good German citizen or aren't you, right? So they say, well, I don't believe in a return to Zion. Now, that didn't work out well, right, in that whole pathway of history. Sacrifices also in the 20th century. By the way, the 19th century German reform, for some reason, were mainly okay with sacrifices. I don't know why. It was working for them. But it's like we inherited a 20th century. It's like top three problems with prayer book concepts. Go. Number one, sacrifice. Number two, personal Messiah, right? You know, give it to me.
Kicking the people out of the land.
Yeah, good, right? Run people out of the land. Okay, good. We can play this game. My point is that the Siddurim are responding to the last objection that's on the table. So one of the great things, one of the amazing lines, anyone grew up with the Silverman Siddur, the black Silverman Siddur? Okay, so Robert Gordon, one of the editors of the Silverman Siddur, writes in an introduction, which was not published in the Siddur, it was only for the rabbis, because we had to like keep the information from the riffraff. And so in the publication, all the rabbis read, he was writing about all the changes that were made in the Siddur. One of them, which is they took out the term Ishei Yisrael, the fires of Israel, because he said, we cannot reinterpret the words fires of Israel, meaning sacrifices of Israel, Ishei Yisrael. Jeremy Kalmanovsky has a great article about this where he basically was like, want to bet? I think we can reinterpret it. And then he sort of goes through the way in which Ishei Yisrael, the fires of Israel, understood in different ways, where you like don't have to read it as specifically referring only to sacrifice. Now, that doesn't, I don't want to whitewash the sacrifice problem. It's there and it is like a big part of what our prayer is meant to mirror. But in terms of interpretation, I actually think there's tremendous things that we could do. I want to offer, can I just offer one version of this before we have to go back downstairs? This is from the Kaddish. Which I feel like is a classic example of something in which we say it, we orient ourselves around the Kaddish, specifically the Mourner's Kaddish, as a stoic, this is an Silverman Siddur, in solemn testimony to that unbroken faith, which links the generations one to another, may all who are in mourning now rise to magnify and sanctify God's holy name. What's the purpose of the Kaddish? Kaddish is to praise God. Because when I lose a loved one, the number one thing I want to do is praise God. No. Okay? So what I want to point out to you is that actually, when we say Yikadal V'Yikadash Shmei Rabbah, it is not a praising of God. It is not a Sheva. It is a Bakasha.
How do I know that? It's not a praise, it's a request. How do I know that? Because all the language from the Siddur almost always comes from the Tanakh, including Yikadal V'Yikadash Shmei Rabbah. And if you look at the middle of page 5, you'll see it here. Okay? Just take a look at page 5. This is in the prophecy of Ezekiel, who says, at the end of time, there's going to be a big war between Gog and Magog, and at the end of time, God's going to come and defeat Gog and bring the new age, bring the messianic age. And ends this prophecy by saying, in the underlined verse here, verse 23, thus will I manifest my greatness and my holiness and make myself known in the sight of many nations, and they shall know that I am the Lord. V'gadilti v'gadishti v'nodati le'nei goyim rabim. Yigadal v'kadash. I will be made great, I will be made holy, when all the nations know me. Is God great and holy now? No. How do I know that? All the nations of the world don't know God. Or the world is crappy. Right? It's a pretty good smell test to know if God is great and holy. In a crappy world, God is not great and holy. Can I ask for a future world in which God is great and God is holy? Yes. You know where I do that? In the Kaddish. The Kaddish itself is calling out to God and saying, I want you to be great, I want you to be holy in the future. Right? This is, and the earliest commentators to the Kaddish, they're right on the bottom of page 5, make this clear. At first he requests from God to hurry his promise, as he promises to the prophet. That's why I manifest my greatness and my holiness, right? You are asking something of God in the Kaddish. You're not saying, God, you're great, you're holy. I am stoically reciting your praises, even though I'm in pain. That's not the Kaddish, in my interpretation. It's actually a request. Things are bad now. That's the Kaddish. And I want them to be better. Yigadal in the future. By the way, we say this in Kedusha. We just said it yesterday. What do we say in Shabbat, Shachrit Kedusha in the morning? Tikadal, v'tikadash, v'toch Yerushalayim Yircha. Is God in Jerusalem right now? No. V'einenu tirena malchudecha. Our eyes shall see the coming of the Lord. It's not a current description. It's a future request. Okay? Now then again, you can take many, many lines. We don't have time for any of them, right? But you can basically eyedropper any line from the Siddur. Because it's coming from the Tanakh, there is layers of interpretation to unmask. Now again, I'm not saying that, like, I'm not whitewashing the Siddur. I'm just saying there is something to be done in terms of interpretation. Okay? That's my main point on that one. Okay? So we've got number one. It is about, could be about, one window is crossing a yearning, right? Coming closer, bovi kared, not bovi paleo. Number two is the language itself has many layers that's meant to be unpeeled. And part of what it means to pray is to engage with those words so that they unfold in different ways at different times. They're not, by the way, each of those interpretations have multiple understandings. It's not like, oh, we had the wrong one, now we have the right one. It's that there are multiple ways to go, and that's what means to unfold over time. I want to offer just one last frame here about this is often to be understood in the difference between, well, let's see, how much time do we have? We have 3 minutes. Okay, I'm going to do this. We have a classic debate, which is keva kavana. Now, the terms keva kavana, to put in opposition to each other, was an invention of Abraham Joshua, as far as I can tell, an invention of Abraham Joshua Heschel in the 20th century. That is to say, the terms keva and kavana are not actually oppositional. Kavana means direction, keva means set or fixed. The way the rabbi saw the tension was not keva kavana, but rather keva tachanun. Keva tachanun. Rabbi Yehuda says, "Aoset tefilato keva, ein tefilato tachanun." If you make your tefillah, your amida keva fixed, you haven't made your amida tachanun. You haven't made it supplicatory. You haven't actually said what you want to say. You haven't brought your own personal prayer. Now, this is something that was recognized so old in rabbinic understanding that they built in systems already to deal with it all the way through. So we often think of the Siddur. That's keva. I got 1,200 pages here. I got to run through it. And then, you know, when I'm in the foxhole, that's when I'm going to give my real kavana, right? But the rabbis actually had a higher bar for this, which they said, if you don't say tachanunim in your amida, you kind of missed the point. So if you look on page 6. I'm going to point it to you, but I'm going to read it on the inside. But look on page 6. It's a long sugya where they're trying to figure out where a person should, shoel adam tzracha, where should a person ask for something in the Amida? And they run through different options. It's actually kind of amazing. Option number one is before the Amida. Option number two is after the Amida. You know what option number three is? In the Amida. They play them all out, okay? Before the Amida, after the Amida, in the Amida. Oh, where in the Amida? Oh, you can do it in Shomei Tefillah. You can do it, you can pray for sick people in Rifayenu. You can pray for Parnasa, which we all must. You know, income, in the crops bracha, okay? There's certain moments of insertion. What can you not do? You cannot run through the entire Amida and say nothing of your own needs. That's unthinkable to them, right? The idea that you would say, oh, I have this fixed text, I'm commanded to say it, and then I'm going to whine about the fact that I didn't write those words. They're like, what are you talking about? The whole thing was set up to be a bracket for your own words. Now, where do we put in our own... What's the answer to the question of where you put it in? Where are our tachanunim? Right. So basically, all of them, except the one before the Amida, which is interesting, but the main one is tachanun. Let's say the service that's called supplication. And that service where we put our heads down and, you know, read these words that were written basically in the 17th century. Before that were a time for everybody to make up your own tefillah. You're supposed to say whatever you want to say in those moments. Because how could you ever think of prayer without your own words? That's bonkers. To them it was bonkers, okay? So it's not like the renewal, you know, moderns figured out that like people have to say their own words. They already hardwired that in. And what I would say is actually the truth is if you want to try it, it's quite hard. Like try praying original prayer three times a day. Try it. It's hard. You have to be in touch with certain aspects of yourself in order to put that out. Okay? So there is a challenge, definitely, between the fixed words and the words in my heart, but they are already working that through in the beginning of the formulation of prayer itself. That is to say, it's not something where you add it on as an add-on. It is already we're trying to figure out where can I best put this in. And interestingly, the answer is pretty much everywhere. Right? You can't make it through without it. Yeah.
Could you give me just a short answer on this? Because we don't have much time.
Go for it.
Where does silence fit in?
Where does silence fit in? Yeah, great. Okay. So, silence. Where's the point of silence in prayer? So I'll say one word about that, and then I'm going to close with one last image. Silence. There is a theory that in the Mikdash, the Kohanim prayed silently. That is to say, there's no liturgy that accompanies sacrifice. Israel Knoll wrote a book about this called The Sanctuary of Silence. It's one of these great books that you don't have to read because you can get it from the title. The Sanctuary of Silence. The Mikdash was silent. That's what it was, okay? And the idea is that the whole operation, by the way, in contrast to all other ancient temple, like cult worship systems, only the Jews had no liturgy. So actually the basic core of silence is deep, deep, deep folded in. Now the question is, where do you get that silence? So I think one answer is the Amida. Instead, the Amida.
But the Amida is also words.
That's true, but not all of it is words. What I'm trying to say is that this long text here is trying to tell you, in the middle of the Amida, you're supposed to say all your own personal words. In fact, the reason why they say, one reason why we say the Amida silently, is because if you were to say it out loud, you wouldn't say what you were going to say because the person next to you would hear you and be embarrassed. Now let me tell you, I'm not embarrassed if you hear me say Tikkah b'shofar gadol lechei retainu or any other of the fixed words that we're all saying in the Siddur. I'm embarrassed if you hear me say, you know, please help me reconcile with my wife, right? That is to say, they already conceived of the silent prayer to be giving voice, although silently, to your own needs. Now, it's complicated because it's not actually pin drop silence because it's whispering. So where do you find, like, the real, real silence? I think probably the only place you can find it is in... the Birkat Kohanim, when I say Yivarecha Adonai V'Yishmerecha as the leader, you can't say anything until I finish. And then when I finish speaking, you say Kein Yehi Ratzon, but there's a split second of silence in there. Maybe. That's not a lot. Okay. I want to just aim with one last image and before we go downstairs. The last image is, and this is, I think, relevant today more than ever, but often not associated with prayer, prayer as social protest. I say the purpose of prayer is to protest the status quo. And who do we learn this from? We learn it from Chana. Okay? We learn it from Chana. Where does Chana say it?
let's take one quick look, if we made it into the source sheet. The rabbis noticed something amazing about Chana. What is it, page 7? Oh, okay, okay, good. It's mislabeled. This is from Brachot 31. Okay? So Chana says, thank you. Chana says, Chana invents the term Adonai Tzevaot. Adonai Tzevaot, Lord of, how do you translate Adonai Tzevaot? Lord of hosts.
Armies.
Armies, right. It's like, I always thought of, like, literally up until probably last year, I thought of Lord of hosts as like, Lord of Bob Barker, and like the guy from Sale of the Century, you know, it's like, the hosts. But actually it means armies, like Tzva Hagana Yisrael, okay? Adonai Tzevaot. So if you look at the Gemara, the very first time that anybody ever says Adonai Tzevaot is Chana. Okay? Now we say Adonai Tzevaot all the time in Tefillah. What does Chana mean when she says Adonai Tzevaot? This is amazing. What is Chana praying for? A child. Okay? By the way, which is not a specific prayer in the Amidah. Amidah covers all different bakashot, not probably what most humans pray for, like in the history of human prayer, which is a child. This is very interesting. She vows a vow to God and calls God the Adonai Tzevaot. First time anyone ever called Adonai Tzevaot. Rabbi Elazar says, from the day in which God created the world, no one ever called the Kodesh Baruch Hu Adonai Tzevaot until Chana came and did it. Now, what does it mean for her to say Adonai Tzevaot? The following. Amra Chana l'fnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She says before God, Ribono shel Olam, Mikol tzivei tzevaot shebarata be'olamecha, kasher be'enecha shetitein li ben echad. From all of the hosts, by the way, what are the hosts? What are the guard of God's armies? The angels, which are the stars. You look up in the sky, and there are a ton of stars. Adonai Tzevaot. From all the hosts that you created stars. That's a big deal. You can't create me having a child. That is to say, Adonai Tzevaot is not a term of praise, a term of respect. It's a term of provocation. You are the Lord of hosts, and you can't give me a child? Now, if you run through this sugya, you'll see that Hanukkah does this over and over in different ways. But what I want to leave you with is an idea that prayer is not only meant to be about praise, or even about request, but about provocation. Right? Hitiach dvarim klape mala, says the Gemara. But Chana hurled things towards heaven. Right? She actually goes after the power system, which is God. She's on the lowest totem pole of the power system. Right? She is a woman without a child. That is not a good place to be in the ancient world. And she's fighting against the highest one, which is Eli the high priest. Somehow they encounter each other, and God. And she's using it through the language that we just run through. Like, Adonai Tzevaot Shemo, right, we say. Now, what does Adonai Tzevaot mean? It's like, can you please do this thing for me? Because you do a lot of other big things. This isn't a big ask for you, right? That's the way in which Chana is framing it. That's saying it's about social protest. Okay, so where do we leave? There's many other windows to go through, but where are we left with now? Tefillah could be about yearning and drawing closer. Tefillah could also be about reinterpreting words that are meant to unfold over time. Example is the Kaddish, right? You're asking for something, you're not praising God. Tefillah is about using our own words in prayer. That's what Tachanun is, and there are certain moments for that. And Tefillah is also about social protest. So there are many, many windows to go through Tefillah. And if none of them work, you can always invent your own 13th window. I hope we've opened up some new vistas for you. Nice to learn with you. We're going to go downstairs for the closing thing with Mainly Jones. See the light.